When I met with Wolfgang Sachs in his native country of Germany, I started by asking him just how green he thought the country was, because I'd noticed recycling bins on station platforms and lots of wind generators across the countryside.
That has been one of the not many achievements of the red-green national governments which rules Germany now for 5 years. Many achievements in the sense that Germany has introduced a very comprehensive plan for incentivizing wind power, now also biomass power, and that has showed very clear successes with the effect that today Germany is the world champion in wind power generation.
And you've traveled to many countries, you've written books, you've lectured. What do you notice about other countries' perspectives on environmental problems, particularly within Europe and even further afield?
One reason why there is not the same or the similar influence of a Green Party in England or in France, or for that matter in the United States even, is very simple. It's the electoral system. The electoral system does not allow small parties in France or in England or in the US to make much headway, to get into parliament. Because with the majority system, there is nearly no way that a smaller group can make it. Now, that is different in Germany. We have the 5% hurdle, which means the moment a party is able to gain 5% of the electorate, they are able to enter parliament. So that, so simple as it is. And of course, the moment, which is now more than 20 years ago, the Greens were able to overcome that hurdle, the Green Party became an important factor.
I'm wondering, really though, are we serious enough about dealing with the planetary problems? Are we serious enough to elect green representatives? Because do we care enough?
Well, sure. I mean, we are light ways away from being serious about, as you said, planetary problems. There is no doubt about it. I would even go so far that we live in a times of monumental suppression of things. You know, like you psychologically of a systematic forgetfulness. That is true for the state of the biosphere. So if you want, there is now a forgetfulness of nature ingrained in our culture, and you have, of course, a let's say forgetfulness with regard to the powerless and poor in the world. Although, and that is the interesting thing, there are many programs and there's lots of rhetoric about, you know, which speaks about the environment or calls attention to the world's poor. But there is a huge gulf between the rhetoric and, you know, the various actions or the real steps the historical process takes.
You've written many books and essays, notably the Development Dictionary, in which you refer to Western development and also our concepts of rich and poor. And you know, how can we classify who is poor and who is rich? That's what I was wondering.
One has to be at least aware that rich and poor is measured in terms of money. Now, that is a very problematic measurement on both sides. It's a problematic measurement on sides of the poor, because there are many people who are simple, or there are many communities which are simple, but they are not poor in the sense of being miserable. So certainly you have to make a difference between misery and poverty. And it is probably unjustified to, let's say, to look into people's eyes and to call them poor in the first place. It happened once to me. Some years ago, we did a little tour through one of the more depressed inner city areas of Mexico City, Tepito. And after the day, I said to the two Mexicans, who came along with me, but at the end said somehow, in the sense, well, but in the end, this is all very nice what we saw, but at the end, they are all poor people. And the guy somehow took a step back and said, no somos pobres, somos tepiteños. So we are not poor, we are from Tepito, we are tepiteños. I in a way offended him by calling him poor. While he would say of himself, I'm in the first place, I'm a tepiteño. Like I would say, I'm a German or what, or, you know. And that is the first characteristic. That's my identity. And I think that there is a violence in the notion of poverty which projects upon other people that the level of income would be the one measure which only and exclusively matters.
One of the statistics that really struck me that you were talking about was it would take 5 or 6 planets to serve us as mines and waste dumps. If all the countries of the world were to become industrialized, and still I'm thinking we're not considering the non-westernized countries enough.
Well, what the notion says is if all countries of the world followed the German example, then we would need 5 planets, and be it only as sinks for the CO2 emissions they will have. Because, I mean, you can make the calculus in that respect, that already today we are beyond the limit the atmosphere can absorb. Now, if all countries had the same annual CO2 emission as Germany, there would be 5 times more emissions than the atmosphere can absorb. What does it say? It says basically, that our style of well-being, our style of production and consumption, is not capable of justice.
Because you've talked about fairness, in regard to the fragility of the world, and as I say, we're still not considering the other parts of the world enough, I guess, for this fairness to happen.
It's a difficult issue. It's maybe not because of inherent greed. It is because we are in the trap of competition. Because you look at competition forces countries to strengthen their competitiveness. It forces, European Union against the US in the World Trade Organizations, and because, of course, the European agriculture or whatever is in danger with US exports, you have to push through certain policies, which happen to be at the detriment of southern countries. Now, the northern interest, if you want, in competitive survival or in competitive success, it's not only of survival, of course, in a way prevails over the interest of those who are much more distant from the table and who, of course, have much less power. And that situation you have very, very often.
What is your view of the way these issues we've been talking about were handled or not handled at the Johannesburg summit?
Let me give 2 answers. The first is, of course, from the point of view of an environmentalist, from the point of view of somebody who has a certain awareness about the state of the biosphere in the world, and the fact that we have ever more people who want to live from this biosphere. So for anybody who has a sensibility in that respect, the Johannesburg Summit was a summit of hypocrisy. It was ridiculous. And in that sense, it was a failure. Because there have been very few decisions which matter in that regard. And even those who have been taken, for instance, in terms of organizing more access to water or also in part to energy and, on the summit, so far as one can see, are not going to be followed up. So even that, what is normally positively decided, it's very often then only on paper, but it will not be translated into reality. However, there's also a second answer. And the second answer is sometimes even stagnation can be a success. Because if you look at the broader picture, it was the very clear politics of 300 American delegates in Johannesburg to roll back the entire process behind Rio, to dismantle important contracts of Rio. And they did not succeed in doing that. So what happened in the days of Johannesburg is that, in a way, the international community kind of got its act together not to allow the Americans to fall back behind Rio. And all final declarations very ceremoniously reconfirm the various Rio commitments.
Can we really handle the global problems and improve on them, though, without America on board?
You have to take into account that, at least in the present situation, and considering the presently ruling elite in the US, there is no point expecting strong multilateral stand. So in such a situation, you're much better off, instead of throwing to the bins multilateralism, to go for, I would say, sub-global commitments, contracts, which is now already happening. That was one of the good moves of the European Union at Johannesburg, that after the aspired or intended commitments on renewable energies fell through because of the US and because of many developing countries, the European Union immediately offered and called for, if you want, a conference and a platform of like-minded countries. So not all of them, but those who want to bring together in the year 2004. So we will have next year, at the invitation of the German government, there will be a large international conference, governmental conference in Bonn on renewable energies, but only of those, but there are now, I guess, nearly 100 countries, which are ready to actively take part.
What do you think is the best way to achieve the goals of a better environment?
Let me offer you three orientations, and I take three words for that. That is efficiency, sufficiency, and consistency. By efficiency, I mean there are many, many possibilities and ways to do the things we do in a better way. Most of it is technological, organizational. Of course, you can run cars at the very same performance with hugely differing kind of fuel efficiency, and so on and so forth. So sure enough, there is lots of possibility. And in particular, if you think how much is being wasted through the life cycle of a product, you know, because products begin over here by carving up a mountain in order to get some ore, and then they end over here, it's a microphone. And along the process, each step is very often very wasteful. And in each step, you can increase the efficiency of it. That already brings you, so far. second orientation, sufficiency. It's obvious that you might have lots of efficiency, but when the overall volume of things, overall growth continues, then the efficiency gains will be eaten up by volume effects. You know, you can have cars which are ever more fuel efficient, which we did have the last 20 years, but when there are more cars and when the people are driving longer and the cars are getting more powerful, we're getting sport utility vehicles instead of smaller ones, this growth effect will cancel out the efficiency effect. So therefore there's an issue of sufficiency there. The question, what do we expect from our technological systems? How much speed do we want? How much comfort do we want? And now the third point, consistency, meaning that ever more the natural inputs being used should be inputs which can be recycled, or even better, inputs which are biodegradable, meaning that the flows we activate are flows which are not strange to nature itself, which means get rid of chemical processes which cannot be absorbed by nature, get rid of fossil combustion which also cannot be absorbed by nature, but emphasize, extend, reinvent and invent anew flows like solar flows, like biomass flows, like wind flows, like nature-based chemistry and so on and so forth, materials and flows which are compatible with natural processes. So that again is another, if you want, another project not only of technology, but it's a project to refashion the material and resource base of an economy.
Are you encouraged by the environment now being in our consciousness on the map, so to speak, as it wasn't 20 years ago, for example?
Yeah, well, but yes, that is true. But to be on a map is not enough. So I would not call that a particular encouragement, although, yes, if you take a longer view, again, if you take a longer view and take it seriously that we speak about a question of a particular magnitude, it is of a magnitude as the issue of religious freedom, or the issue of social justice, or the issue of the freedom of the press, you know, the basic human rights. And these issues have been with us for centuries, but they aren't solved yet today. So I guess one has to look at ecology, at, let's say, in a broader sense, how, in a way, modern or industrial man can relate to nature. One has to look at it in these terms. So it is probably not adequate to expect to look in terms of problem and solution. That's also kind of language of a managerial kind. And it is an ever-enduring conflict which will stay with us, which will be solved to some extent only to be reopened in another way, and to be solved to some extent reopened in another way. And in that sense, yes, it is encouraging to see yourself as part of a larger story, of a larger historical process, and maybe this implies also a kind of modesty and also in realism, which, by the other hand, is encouraging, because you don't need to have, in a way, in that sense, quick success and quick solution, because there is no quick solution and quick success which would match the gravity and the magnitude of the problem.
And your impact, what impact do you feel that you've been able to make?
You know, as for an intellectual's job is to craft tools of understanding. And when somebody says, well, I've heard you talking, I've heard you discussing, I have read something, and I found it very interesting, and I thought, aha, yeah, yeah, this is, one could look at it. Then I think, but in a little bit, in an incremental way, I have done what I should do. And in that sense, a writer or speaker or intellectual is not different from, let's say, a goldsmith or any artisan who likes to be appreciated through the, you know, the quality of his fruits or his works.
Wolfgang Sachs, who still writes and lectures, indeed, at Schumacher College in Devon in England. And for more information, follow the links on the article page.